A special message from the Plastic Bagger Studio. As the straight ally to the Lit Podcast with the most gay men on it, I'd love to wish you both a very happy Pride Month. And I would want to wish all our LGBTQ listeners a happy Pride Month as well. We live in turbulent times. And even most corporations this year didn't change their Twitter icons to the rainbow colors we've all come to expect every June. But, as one of the few straight men who've been told by numerous lesbian women, trans men, and numerous other members of the queer community that they were surprised by my taste of pop music, my knowledge of pop girlies, I just wanted to say, you too deserve happiness. You deserve peace and all the good things that come along with being out and being who you want to be. Don't let these turbulent times get you down. I mean, even your old uncle, Plastic Bagger, went through an edgelord era, and I might have used some of the words that were once used against you guys, but I'm over that now. I'm woke again, and I just wanted to say, if you're struggling because of your sexual identity, you could always reach out on the timeline, and I'll raise out my hand and help you back up on your feet. Because you deserve that compassion. And you deserve to have a good day. Happy Pride Month from Response Pod.
Let's talk Wallace. So I've read your pop manifesto a few. Well, first, oh man, I forgot to do this. I said I was going to do this. Both of you, where do your ideas come from?
Well, I think we lost Chloe.
Holy shit!
At least momentarily.
You don't have to answer that.
Okay. So now,
but you can.
Okay.
You can open answer it if you want.
No, I don't. I was just gonna try to spitball something because I it is kind of a hard question, or like, you know, they come from my brain. I don't know.
Well, that's how Chloe jumps back on here. But I got you here. I've read your manifesto, and I've read different. I've listened to, I guess, your Lo-Fi Lit interview. So I tried to do my research and stuff like that. And so I want to know, let me see. What is the difference, between pop as you describe it and just postmodernism, or, or maybe just what is pop to you? And I know the manifesto says this and stuff like that. And I think it's, concise, kind of, it just seems like it's postmodernism to me.
Yeah, well, I think that was kind of one of the insights, or for me, one of the things is that, like, postmodernism. First off, postmodernism is kind of a weird term, right? It's just sort of like it's what comes after modernism. It doesn't really it's not like other sort of artistic movements where it sort of describes itself like imagism or romanticism or realism, or it's just like it's after modernism. But we know what postmodernism is referring to. It's a kind of like meta. Deconstructed narratives and things and breaking the fourth wall. And postmodernism is really not a useful term because the artistic movement of which postmodernist ideas are often embodied is pop. I mean, pop is really the aesthetic artistic movement. Postmodernism is kind of like some ideas that can influence your art.
So you mean like pop art?
Yeah, pop art, but I think pop as an artistic movement is so successful. It's been become so successful that sort of everything is pop. It's hard to find art that would not be pop. And I think that that's what post-pop lit is about. It's like if we can break through to post-pop, to something beyond pop, that would be truly new because pop is like hegemonic, you know, it's such a pervasive artistic stance, posture. And I think it's important to understand too that pop is not popular. You can write, you know, for a very small audience or no audience and still be writing pop things, making pop things, whether it's writing or music or whatever. So pop is not about just being popular. It's about a set of sort of aesthetic and aesthetic approaches and ideas around, you know, how you speak to your audience and things like that. So that really the animating idea with post-pop is that we have to think of pop as an art mu movement, just like romanticism or realism or modernism. And if we do that, if you're willing to take that step and view pop not as a genre, but as an actual like artistic movement, then it opens up this whole window. Okay, well, you know, it's not pop is not good or bad any more than romanticism is good or bad. But we should try to get past it. You know, what lies beyond pop? And pop is so all-encompassing that it's hard to break out of it. It's like, you know, the fish in water problem where fish don't know they're wet, you know, and we don't know we're immersed in pop.
So what would be the characteristics of a pop art piece?
Well, I think there are aspects of like digestibility for the audience. You know, that's the stuff that's sort of the low-hanging fruit with pop is like, well, it's got to be something that is catchy, whether it's what, you know, no matter what type of art we're talking about, music, writing, painting, got to be catchy and digestible. Pop usually doesn't ask too much of the audience in terms of thinking and applying their own reasoning to things. It kind of serves it up on a platter, but that's just sort of like the low-hanging fruit. The more I think key aspect of pop is that it's inclusive in a kind of clubby, clicky way. Like if you're willing to be sort of like a poptimist and enjoy pop on its own terms, then you're in the club and pop is like winking at you, and it's welcoming you, and you know, everyone's welcome. If you are critical of pop, then now you're the kind of butt of the joke. You're the one that all the other people in the pop in group are looking at. This person just doesn't get it. Because you'd only, because pop has d internal defenses against criticism, which is essentially like, if you criticize pop, you're just being, you know, you don't get it. You're not in on the joke. You're not understanding. Yes, everybody knows this pop artifact is flimsy or disposable or whatever, but that's, hey, we're just having fun here, you know? Like, you're suspect if you criticize pop, or worse than suspect, you're oblivious to the fact that everybody is in on the joke but you. You're on the outside of things. And so pop protects itself that way. So there's a very like I'll say postmodernism, like meta aspect of pop where it's winking at you. It's, you know, it's giving you the little nudge in the ribs or whatever. Like you get it. You know what we're doing here. You know, I think one thing you mentioned, David, this David Foster Wallace essay that I quoted in the Post-Pop Manifesto called, I think it's called E Unibus Plurum. And he talks about how, you know, modernism or sort of whatever came before. And I'm going to mangle this quote because I don't have it in front of me, but he talks about how art represented a creative instantation, a creative creation of new values. And pop, what I call pop, he's not explicitly calling it pop, but that's my spin on it. But sort of the postmodern world of mass media has changed that to where now art is a creative rejection of bogus values. So the pop person, the pop artist is beginning from the pose of a sort of bad boy. They're sort of, you know, smirking at the quaint values that you know other people hold, and they're sort of revealing those values to be bogus. And so it's not really, pop doesn't create new values. It doesn't offer you new values. It exposes old values as being dated, fussy, unnecessary, lame, boring, you know. So that pose, I think, is really key to pop.
Okay. Well, I think I see what you're saying. And so with post-pop, you curate it, right? And so I would say that your what you choose is, would you say, is what is representative of what you want post-pop to be, or is it the starting seeds of what this kind of new way of thinking about art is supposed to be? You feel me?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I so post-pop lit is like a sandbox. There's nothing prescriptive about it. I don't have an idea of what post-pop lit should be or could be or is. I'm finding writers I like, and I'm asking them to show us a vision of what post-pop could be in their mind. It's like a provocation, you know? And so I view us as like we're all scientists or explorers trying to find this thing. It's really hard. Like I said, it's like the fish and water problem. Like, how do you, if you're a fish, how do you like discover what's going on land? You know what I mean? It requires genius. We were talking about genius earlier a little bit, David, and I think it will take a moment of genius, and there will be a lot of stuff that isn't it. You know, most stuff will be not it. But if we break through, if we establish something that we can call post-pop, that would be really cool. That would be the purpose of the avant-garde, right? I mean, so that's what I want it to be. And if I knew what post-pop was, I would just write it, but I don't. And so I'm asking other writers to help.
Yeah, of course. You see, I think philosophically, I think I'm in disagreement, complete disagreement with you. But this isn't this is
No, please. I love that. Please share.
I think right now aspirations for writing are on the floor. I think it's been a big mistake to try and mold ourselves to these short attention span kind of things. I think a lot of writing that gets done today, especially in our little scene, is regurgitated stuff that's already been done, maybe highly conceptual. Like we were talking about before, like seems more interested in writers watching themselves and watching how they react to the world instead of trying to comment to the world or make someone understand things. And I guess problems I have with not everything in the first post-pop, but there was a lot of stuff. I'm not going to put people on blast about what they think of, but like stuff that is seems like the opposite away, seems cynical. Seems like it's against this kind of post-pop kind of thing, which seems like to be like more of a return to sincerity, or authenticity, which you get into later. But this, and a lot of the stuff didn't seem that well. Like I don't care, he's big enough. So like Zach Smith's submission is like an inst it's just an instruction manual, and it is cool to think of like, oh, this instruction manual to like a machine that no one's seen and stuff. And the last line is really nice and stuff like that. But it's like, where's the way inside? What is that? Seems like a smirking joke, right? You know what I mean? Doesn't that seem like a wink or a nod? You feel me?
Yeah, no, totally. I get exactly what you're saying. I mean, I would just say again, you know, like not every piece is, you know, if we get one piece in the whole run of the magazine that shows the way, then that would be amazing. And now I'm not saying that because I think Zach Smith's piece isn't that piece. I think partly what he's playing with is the idea of not catering to the reader, not giving the reader a little tickle, you know, giving them something that is harder, more challenging. And you know the risk with that, of course, is that it's not worth reading. You could, you know, that's if you're too hard on the reader, then it's sort of like, well, maybe I just won't read this. But I think that's what he's playing with, and you know, we could debate where is he successful or not. But I don't think that that's the only, you know, route to pop to post pop. I do think there's a world in which post pop can be highly accessible and digestible, just like pop. I don't know that it needs to not be fun, you
Yeah,
know.
I honestly think that we should take more cues from not pop as you describe it, but more cues from popular culture kind of things, giving people a way into, because I just think people don't want to read this shit. You know what I mean? Because it is a lot of it is like experiment, like trying to do experimental kind of writing, that doesn't have like the background, you know, not like the background to be able to experiment m much. And that in itself, like I think David Foster Wallace said this as well, like that there's just like such a learning curve that you have to take up in order to start understanding these kind of things. And I feel like it should be, because it's not that people don't want to read. People do want to read. That's why I have a whole big thing about how I hate word limits and I hate a lot of short stuff. I think it makes us stupider, it makes our writing worse, blah blah blah. But there is an independent publishing boom happening right now, but it's just in these scenes that we look down on, maybe rightfully so, because they come out of fan fiction or they come out of fantasy or genre fiction. But those mostly women are fucking not only making bank, but they are proving that people want to read. People are reading these fucking seven novel things. I think it's like
Oh,
you
yeah.
need a way inside. And I think that's the direction forward. I guess we had talked about craft versus concept, and I guess I'm just on the other side of the boat. I think craft is the most important thing, and bringing people into the world, making them feel, and then they can take something back from that. And I think we just have a lot of cold or self-obsessed or overly conceptual or structural things. And I think post-pop, if we're going to use your what you say is pop, it should be trying to find a way to emotionally evolved. How can we connect in new ways on an emo, because that's what people want when they read. That's the soul of, you know what I mean? And if we want to bring more people into this and get more people interested in it, I think that's just the path. Writing a good story, not wasting someone's time, because people do want to read. It's just they don't want to read this experimental shit. And I'm not saying post-pop is that. I really liked Anna's story. I liked all August Smith's poem, even if he is kind of prone to some purple prose there. I guess it's poetry, right? It's poetry. But you see what I'm saying? I don't know if I'm making a good argument for this.
No, I totally see what you're saying. I totally see what you're saying. I mean, one thing is, I don't necessarily feel like I'm like an evangelist to try to get other people to read. I, you know, if other people read or not, like that's kind of their business. I, you know, that's like, I'm not a teacher. I'm not, you know,
I
so
feel that. I respect that. Yeah.
yeah, but so, but I hear that, you know, there is a lot of that within writing circles. Like, oh my gosh, how do we, you know, the general public doesn't read anymore or whatever. But it's, to me, it's kind of like, well, okay, if it's fine. But I think from an art movement, a new art movement, for in order for it to be successful, and what drives people wild and creates a just a phenomenon of a new art movement is people want a new way to be cool. They're tired of the old ways of being cool. Modernism presented people with a new way of being cool, a type of character you could be that would be cool, that was different from how what was cool before. You know, then the beats come along, and the beats show everyone a brand new way to be cool that hadn't been done before. And then, you know, fast forward even to like something like grunge or something, the rise of Seattle grunge, like, oh, this is an entirely new way to be cool that no one had ever thought of before. And that is what will drive mania, you know, Beatlemania or something. If you show someone a way to be cool that they like, that they had never thought of and would never have thought of on their own, that's awesome. Because like right now, what a lot of art does is it's just reiterating the, or maybe kind of like minor tweaks on the existing ways of being cool, you know?
Yes, I definitely agree with you. I think, yeah, that's a good point. It's not something I thought of. I wonder if, with how stratified and fragmented just culture is now, of whether that's possible again. You know what I mean? Especially like you and I, we lived through the age of watching like there be a mass culture. You know, it's kind of weird, you know. There is like a come to God moment, at least back then, you know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, there's stuff that's not just on the radio. There's stuff that's not just on the TV. And it is like a, like I said, like a come to God wiping of the slate of being like, oh, wow. And I wonder if people really have that anymore, because there's not some kind of hegemonic, only way you get it. Because, yeah, there is a pop mainstream now, but it is augmented and supplemented by all these offshoots of things, and almost like time is forever. You know what I mean? Every movement lives forever now, and these little subcultures that people can take and do, make of that what you will. You feel what I'm saying? So I wonder if that's
I totally agree. You're saying that it's not. I mean, just the way media or delivery of media has evolved from where we had the few choices, and you kind of had to, you had to reckon with whatever they were presenting to you. Whereas now you can seek out anything, and genres don't have to die, or ideas don't have to die. They can be a subculture forever, with the whole community. But I think in a way that almost sets this like there's an. There's like an incredibly fertile ground now. The stage is set. I mean, we haven't really seen in the internet age, we haven't really seen a sort of like massively new way of being in the way that we had those. And I think the internet makes it hard for reasons you just kind of described. But I think that would be like if po that's what kind of what I'm getting at with if one thing Post-Pop publishes in its entire run shows the way. I think, it's like it's like a bunch of tinder, if somebody can light a match, I think it could explode. Do we want to do? I'm just throwing this out there. Do we want to do videos? So that because I know sometimes podcasts like do little teasers where they show people talking and stuff.
I would rather die.
Yeah, and
Okay, there you go. Then fine by me. Let's not.
I don't have a camera on my PC. I did an interview with the what's this guy? What's the guy's name? The
Blake Butler.
no. God, he does the lit podcast, the Lo-Fi
Lo-Fi
Lit.
Lit, Tyler.
Yes, and he wanted video, so I had to sign in twice to his call and set up a cell phone, and it was this whole fucking stupid thing.
Oh no.
Yeah, I did Lo-Fi too, and he did like some teaser vids that got a little action. So I don't know, I thought it was kind of a cool thing, but yeah, totally. Either way, it's fun.
He's such a scattered interviewer. He's so,
Yeah.
he's so.
He thought you were hot, I think. That's
No, he got very sexual sometimes.
you're married.
See, the funny thing is I'd listen to him and I didn't know he was gay. And so I was like, he's so aggressive, almost like rude, you know what I mean? Like cuts people off kind of thing. And I just thought he was kind of an asshole maybe, or something. And then I realized he was gay. I heard he was gay and I was like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. It makes you're allowed, a little bit of edge to it. Okay. Welcome back to the Response Pod interview episode, Response Pod. And we
We get lit with it.
yeah. So last episode or not, we tried to do this before and then Chloe cut out, and so we got a lot of stuff with Wallace. So we're gonna start with Chloe this time. And Chloe, you should have heard the stuff he was saying about you. He's like, she's
Oh, you
bitch,
have to wait.
she's
Oh,
ugly. She,
no. It was awful. It was very distasteful.
Oh, goodness.
We actually didn't talk at all about you, which is maybe worse.
Last time we
Yeah,
talked, it
man.
didn't record, but I found out Larry Bird was white. And it was
Yes.
pretty crazy because I'm a Jew and I
<It's>
like.
But Larry Bird, that's like the one thing though that he's
I
white.
didn't know.
So yeah, we'll be starting with Chloe. And no, we didn't say anything bad about you. Like I said, we didn't really talk about you, which is maybe, if they're not talking about you, that's not good, right? I don't know.
Right. All press is bad press, right? So.
Or something like that. I don't know. I do have three questions that Mari, who's Plastic Bagger, also a New York boy, wanted to ask, and I don't think he really wants answers to these guys, but
What did he ask?
so the first one is he wants to know your guys's step count for today, how many steps you had.
Important.
Oh God, yeah, I see him posting about that all the time.
He's
And
crazy. He's like a homeless guy. He just walks around.
I used to like have a Fitbit and I was really obsessed with it and I just like march for hours while I watched my 600-pound life. I get so many steps, bro.
Disordered behavior is what that's
Oh
about.
my God. They say that. Yeah. I used to, when I was eating disordered, I would count my steps really crazy.
I have that too,
It's actually like it goes the opposite way because now that I don't track my steps, I'll look back at like my app pedometer and it'll be like through the roof. And I'm like, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was just going out. But I love walking. I just, sadly to say to Plastic Bagger today, I literally haven't walked at all. I did do yoga though, so.
I love yoga. It's so good.
Yeah, it's my favorite. And I just started doing it again because I wasn't doing it because I was homeless for a few months.
That
And
sucks.
yeah, you can't do yoga while homeless. It's not good.
Very difficult.
You could.
Lots of space for the mat, you know.
I see people doing yoga in the park.
They do that, but it was more mostly like, okay, I'm just trying to survive. I couldn't get in the headspace. But you know, I really could have done it in an alley or something. I mean, I did have access to alleys and whatnot, and
That's not good.
there was this homeless guy. Me and my dad and my stepmom, when I was like a younger teenager, lived in this really fancy condo. I'm from Seattle. And there was this homeless guy who would routinely piss on our wall like every day at like 6 o'clock when my dad walked to work to go to his job denying veterans benefits. And my dad would walk by him every time. And my dad's super passive and like kind of gay. So he would be like, "Can you please not do that? Can you please not do that? This is unacceptable." And the guy would just like, he'd still piss there every day.
Out of spite or something. Like he was like,
It was awesome. He should have done it out of spite. Yeah, I would piss on my dad's wall out of spite.
mean, it was at this point, it would be out of spite. You know, if someone tells you not to do that and they're being a pussy about it as well, it's just like, well, I'm going to piss here every.
You gotta piss. David used to, what'd you do? You smashed a burrito when you were really drunk on the windshield of that car.
This is not an interview about the stuff I was doing. You know, it's funny because you guys were different classes at home. You were a crust punk.
Yeah.
Yes. And Chloe did not look like. Chloe, do you even know what a crust punk is?
I do. I don't know. Do they still exist? But I am like somewhat aware. One of my friends used to be a crust punk and he was living in some like crust punk house and then
Ugh.
they kicked him and then he ended up in Times Square. So
That sucks.
yeah, but imagine like what he was getting up to if he got like kicked out of a crust punk house.
Ugh. Yeah, it can't be good.
He must have been doing something kind
Untoward.
of crazy and
Or maybe he was just getting really straight laced and got a good haircut and
yeah,
was
he
showering
sold
and
out.
stuff, and they're like, "You're out, buddy."
Honestly, I mean, I love the guy, so I'm sure he was doing something cool. I don't know. No, I
Yeah.
was kind of other homeless, a secret third homeless. I don't know. I was
Secret third homeless.
but you know, it was sort of those things where it was like, okay, where am I staying tonight? How am I gonna get food? Like, what's this? Like, it was survival mode. But I had a lot of fun. It's not sustainable whatsoever. And now that I have
No.
place, I'm so boring now and normal, but it's so nice.
Yeah, and I guess it's good that you were able to get that kind of, because there's, especially when you're younger, there's such like an, I mean, I was a crust punk as well. It's like it was, there's such a lure to that kind of thing, and there is a freedom
Yeah.
to it, but then an incredible boredom, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like the same, you know, you do the same things over and over again. It doesn't matter how fun it is, it gets some point and boring at some point. The monotony strikes. It was like, yeah, I would like stay at afters, you know, just trying to secure a place and like, you know, you have to resort to things just to stay up and it wasn't sustainable. And Yeah, so now I can be like, I'm going home early. Like a couple drinks at like a reading or something, and then I'll like smoke weed and go to bed.
A luxury.
You see, I had such a different experience being homeless because I was, especially at that point, I was just a very severe guy, and now I'm very sociable, but not, I wasn't. I didn't want to talk to anyone, so it's like I had like no charisma, no, didn't want to talk, so I just didn't talk to people and just.
You walked everywhere instead of like hitched or
Yeah, I
like
didn't want to
whatever.
hitchhike. I like the woods. I'm an Appalachian boy.
You are an Appalachian boy. You know all about the woods.
My
PA's pretty.
PA's pretty. Wallace, what was your step count?
I've been at work all day, and I do have kind of an email job, so I have not been doing a bunch of steps. But I did run. I run 4 miles this morning, so I did a run this morning.
Oh,
Yeah,
that's
that's
healthy.
healthy. Yeah, it's all right.
okay, so his other question was, this one's, how do you live with yourself?
Oh,
I don't think he wants that answered. You don't have to answer that.
how do
How
you?
do you live with yourself is the question.
Yes, he's.
I think it's a good question, Chloe. How do you live with yourself?
Delusion and denial, I think.
A good one.
Yeah, that's how I do it, and it works.
People talk shit about cope, but it's like cope's the best thing I've ever had. You know what I mean? I don't know what else I would have without cope. It's the best thing. What do you want? You know.
I mean, I don't cope. God just talks to me and loves me,
Don't
bro.
get on this. We're not gonna.
It's true.
It doesn't matter. Lynn's gonna take over this interview with Chloe for a bit.
Oh, fuck. Okay. I got this. Okay. So, let's see. Have you ever seen an alien?
What was that? Have I ever seen Alien?
Yeah. Have you ever seen one? I was thinking about this. I wanted to ask you about it.
Like an actual alien? No.
So David says this isn't true, but I saw a gold alien come out of my grandfather's grandfather clock when I was like 5 or 6. It was gold. It looked like a gray alien, but it was gold and it was shining, and it just walked out of the grandfather clock and like stared at me, and I was like, oh fuck.
Did it do anything else? Like, did it send you like a telepathic message or something? Or just.
So I feel like maybe something happened. Maybe I got abducted or something. I don't know, like a Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Maybe I repressed it, like satanic panic style
Yeah.
or something.
I mean, I believe in aliens. I mean, I feel like it would be very like species narcissistic to think that,
Yeah.
even Earth narcissistic to think that we're the only life forms. And I'm sure that they've been around and like hung out with us, and we just like don't know that that's what that is, or we do.
I feel like who would want to hang out with us? We're bad.
Yeah, we're kind of, yeah, I agree. So they probably, there's probably not more alien action because they're like, oh yeah, that planet, I think they're cooked. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I am a human, so I have to love humans, even though I'm kind of
No, you don't. No, you don't.
David's very anti-human.
I'm both, I think. Me and my friends used to talk about how we're like misanthropes who love humanity.
I feel that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 'Cause you've got to, we're all in this together. We're all connected. But yeah, I mean, I believe in aliens. I guess I haven't seen one. I'll believe when I see, but
You will. David thinks everyone should die.
everyone.
Well, they will, David. Don't
Yeah,
worry.
like everyone.
Yeah,
Not in the context of aliens. He just generally thinks like everyone should die.
well,
He's laughing, but it's true. I've heard you say this so many
I mean,
ah,
it's kind of
yes.
like global warming. I'm like, okay, whether or not it's real, like
It's real. It's real. Don't
it's real. No, but
Do you think global warming's real, Chloe?
we're the ones who have to worry. The Earth will be fine. We will be the ones who are sort of extricated from this Earth situation, and the Earth will heal. Like we're gonna perish, but everything else will be
Yeah.
fine.
All right. Well, it will not.
Yeah.
Mute your mic. Let me go off. Let me black pill her
Okay,
on here.
do it,
Okay.
do it.
So the Earth will not be fine. And there's already parts,
No.
especially with cobalt and lithium mining, where these things get dug up. And well, you can already think about microplastics. It's a similar kind of thing where the land is just completely ruined. It is literally like a Cthulhu abyss that we are bringing to the world and already is brought to the world. Like, take the Congo, like, they can't grow anything there, and they'll never be able to grow anything there unless we come up with some kind of miracle. But, like, literally from alkali metal exposure, like, those things won't be, like, the land is ruined. It is ruined. It's worse than salting it. And then we're doing the same thing to the ocean, especially when we start it. The world will not recover. But that's fine. We should keep living. What else are we going to do? But no, the world will not recover. It is a horrible hell that is coming. But anyway, okay, I'm done. You continue your interview. That's my thing. Yes, the world will not recover. It is over, brother.
Oh,
That's bad. Oh, so I have a question. I think I saw your post today. I hope it was you. I think it was you. I'm retarded as fuck. But I think you said you were gonna go watch Play It As It Lays with Tuesday Weld, and it was your favorite book, and I didn't know it was a book. So what are your some of your favorite books?
Well, it wasn't me.
Fuck.
I saw that post. That was Anna Krivolapova.
It's all good. I mean, Twitter is just a constant onslaught of text-based posts, and it's like, who said what? I mean,
I don't even know if it's me or not.
but favorite books, I can kind of answer that. I feel like
Please do.
it's a hard question. There are so many books and so many options, but I guess my like default answer is my favorite like work of like fiction would probably be The Waves by Virginia Woolf. I adore that book. I took a class that was just Virginia Woolf's work, and we like
Oh,
did
that's cool.
thing. Yeah, but The Waves, I read that and I was like, as somebody who's primarily focused like on poetry in my life, it was just like such an incredible work. And I was thinking about this earlier. It's about like, for those who haven't read it, about a
I
group
have not.
of friends through their entire lives, starting in childhood and ending in death,
Oh, wow.
and how lives of these people like intertwined, and even though they, went on to live different experiences and separate and together, just the interwovenness of a friend group, how it kind of becomes one singular entity.
Yeah, I understand.
I'm like all about friends, and it really moved me, and the way that it's written is incredible.
I think platonic love is very undervalued, but it's very important. Like some of the most loving, like giving relationships I've ever had are with people who are my friends, and I feel like they value romance so much over everything, but the love you have for your friends is so powerful. And I don't know, I've had the same best friend for like 11 years. Which is maybe a lot, not a long time, but it's the longest friend I've ever had, except David. I talk to them every day for hours, and it's just like, I don't know. Your lives do intertwine very interestingly, and it's pretty beautiful not to be real gay about it.
No, it is.
What do you like about Virginia Woolf?
I mean, I can't. I mean, the whole we did a whole like biographical like study of her and whatnot, and I don't recall as much as I should from that, but I think that her work is very her body of work was very, starting with like Mrs. Dalloway and going through the course of her life, and she really did like have very interesting jumps in her each book that she wrote. She spent a lot of time on them. Orlando, I believe, was the book she finished the quickest, and that one is fucking hilarious.
Yeah, it's funny to talk about Plutonic love and friendship, especially when talking about Virginia Woolf, because a lot of her work really deals with, it has such a it's usually very funny, but has such emotional intelligence to it, especially in interpersonal relationships, you know what I mean? Without being very flowery or being caving too much to like a kind of Jane Austen kind of emotionalism, if that makes
Don't
sense.
like Jane Austen. I don't like it at all.
Chloe, when Wallace and I were talking before, we were talking about the whole project of Post-Pop Lit and of just like what comes after this current stage we're in of we kind of disagreed on different things about what kind of movement is happening right now. But I guess the gist of it is he wants post-pop to be like a playground or a sandbox for people to imagine what comes next. And so since you were selected as a voice to do this, what do you think should come next, and what will your piece try and do in that respect?
That's a very good question. I mean, first of all, I'm honored to have been selected. I used to be quite a pessimist when it came to like what came next. And I think it was kind of I was very interested in like the alienation and the atomization of culture, and I was also not online as much as I am now, and I just was like, what do I even do as a writer? I feel like nobody wants, who reads? I mean, I didn't have any read, and at the time, and I was like, what does come next? And now I don't know if I think about it as much, but I do feel like something is happening. I don't know. The internet has definitely changed the way that we interact with literature. But I guess my whole thing is, as someone who writes primarily poetry, I like the fact that poetry is kind of coming back into vogue. I'm not necessarily much of a fan of like, I don't even know how to say her name correctly, but like the Rupi Kaurs of the world.
Rupi Kaur, awful,
Yeah,
awful.
yeah. But what I will say is that because that was so popular, and we've kind of the Tumblr poetry of it all, and Twitter poetry of it all. Well, I feel like in the in short term media or short form media rather world, poetry is kind of like, a poetry book is akin to like scrolling through Twitter. And I think that brevity is important. I also feel that way when it comes to readings. I was just talking about this with my friend Cassidy, who hosts this reading series called Confessions every Sunday. And yeah, no, this is like, it's really cool. It's at KGB Bar. But yeah, it happens every week. And something that I've noticed about, going to a lot of readings is like, our attention spans are obviously shorter than they used to be, and it's interesting when writers kind of go up and read and don't have any, it seems that they don't have any like situational awareness of the fact that that's the case, and they like drone on and on and on and on and on. And while, for us, writers and people who enjoy literature, it's one thing when you're reading a book and you have that sort of book focus. But when you're hearing somebody read for that long, you definitely lose the plot, like quite literally. Brevity and punchiness is the way to, I think, just I don't know. What's the word? Reintroduce people back into that world. I don't know. I'm rambling now. I don't even know what I'm saying. But I think poetry and brevity, the short story, and shorter works are kind of what really hits nowadays. So that's what I think.
I think I disagree with you almost entirely, but
Yeah, no, I would be curious to hear what you have to say.
Kaikki sitä johtohommiin pääseekin. On nyt jo tyhjä joka jätkän takki, mutta verotus vain jatkuu hurjemmin. On aivan turhaa enää tehdä työtä, verot vievät koko palkan kuitenkin. Saa viettää montaa unetonta yötä, herrat teki elämästä herran.
terve vin. Haistakaa paska koko valtiovalta, ette osaa muuta kuin verottaa.
I was going to say, if I could, I was just going to say something about what Chloe was saying about readings and stuff and how, you know, you get that phenomenon of some readers, you know, kind of can't read the room and they're like, you know, reading their 10th poem and everybody's sort of like checking their watches. But have you guys ever seen, so do y'all know that Tao Lin poem, And Then We Ate Whale?
And he just keeps saying it over and over again, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
when I was 5, I went fishing with my family and the first day we caught snapper and we had snapper for dinner. Then it's like the next day we caught a salmon, we had salmon for dinner. And then he's like, then the next day we caught a whale and we had whale for dinner. And then he says, and the next night we ate whale and then we ate whale and then we ate whale. And he literally says it like 100 times or something.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah. And there's a great video, which I can't find. I was actually just kind of Googling around for it. But like it's at a reading somewhere in Brooklyn and he does it. And, you know, it's a crowd of kind of like early 2000s hipsters, you know, in some bar in Brooklyn. And It's one of my favorite reading performances because they don't know the poem going into it. They don't know what he's about to do. And like this ripple goes through the room as the, at first they're like kind of giggling. And then this like ripple of recognition goes on through the room where they realize like, he's just going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And he does. And, you know, he's got a very kind of like monotone delivery.
Yes, he does.
He's not smiling. He's not laughing. He's not chuckling at all. And it reminds me a lot of like, if you guys are familiar with like Philip Glass compositions, where there's that famous one where he doesn't actually play anything. He just goes out and sits at the piano for like 4 minutes or something.
That's the John Cage one.
John Cage. Yes, you're right.
I love that.
So it has that effect where the poem and the performance becomes not Tao, but like the crowd and how they're sort of growing increasingly uncomfortable. They kind of like go from like delight to confusion to, you know, discomfort. And you can see it in this video, which I can't find. I don't know if it's been erased from the internet, but it's like the opposite kind of what Clay was like. Well, I mean, he's definitely not reading the room because he's sort of like alienating his audience, but it actually is like a great piece of art, I think, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. He's controlling the space. I mean, that's what you'd want, right? At a reading, that you are controlling the room and dictating how the crowd goes with your words. And sometimes, you know, people aren't into that or whatever, but it doesn't matter if it's a strong enough, not piece, but performance.
Well, then I feel like it does like actually demonstrate a complete awareness of the room in that you're subverting the expectation of what a reading would be. Like that I love. And so, yeah, it's like, maybe even if that's not his intention, it does create, it's like you're fucking with the audience, and the audience in a way does and does not want to be fucked with. And I think that's actually an effective piece. You're like moving people.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe even playing on those, the notion of those readers who don't understand what's going on and will just word vomit for 20 minutes. And that's sick as hell. So
I've talked about Tao Lin before a lot on this podcast, not always as just little jokes, but like back in the day, it was like a punk rock kind of thing, which seems weird to attribute to Tao Lin because he's a very not punk rock guy.
I know exactly what you mean, David. There was something very punk about Tao Lin in his early phase. Yeah.
Just like this kind of what I'd call like kind of like a neo anti-fiction. You know what I mean? And that shit was cool because it was like a subverting of expectations, what is really considered art and stuff like that. And I guess I have a problem kind of with his lineage from that, his influence on that, because you see people trying to do that stuff now, but it's been done, and it's not in the same context. It's in a world that already exists with Bed and Tao Lin doing those kind of things, so it doesn't have that kind of it's hacky now, I guess, if that makes sense. But for sure, like that way, and I think Tao knows what he's doing.
And
I think, Wallace, you've said before about Tao Lin seemed very sincere, and I think I guess I take issue with that, especially in his early work, where I think he's really trying to come off as sincere, but it's a very constructed thing. You know, it's like kind of, there is so much self-awareness and irony, especially in his early stuff.
Well, that was actually the topic of a lot of discussion in the early part of Tylin's career among his fans or just people who knew him. There was always sort of like scuttlebutt or like under the radar whisperings that, hey, if you actually know Tylin in person, he's much more like calculating and kind of contrived than his persona, because his persona does come off as very like sincere, authentic, like, you know, love him or hate him, he's just sort of like in a quasi like autistic almost way, like just putting himself out there, you know, in the best way he understands. But yeah, in the early days of Tao, there was a lot of like,
I can imagine,
you would hear whispers of like, yeah, you know, if you really talk to Tao, you find out he's like a very like cynical.
I always hate that kind of shit. Who the fuck cares about the author at all? I mean, I'm not really it can add stuff to the things, but it's like, who the fuck cares if Tao Lin is actually like a secret cruel little monster guy? He's not. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I don't know the answer. I mean, I like I said, it was always just like a little topic of gossip, but I never knew him personally, so I wouldn't be in a position to comment. But
you can comment. Go ahead. Go on. I'm joking.
Well, I think just based on observing him from a distance, you know, in a parasocial way, you could say, I would say like there probably is, you know, I think he's really smart. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm,
definitely.
And so, you know, I do think some of what he does is more calculated than it may appear on the surface. But I don't think, my sense is that it's not fair to like accuse him of being entirely cynical and just like creating a public persona that's totally,
yeah,
you know, fake or something.
Yeah, I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's fair, but I think there is a cynicism in the work. But it's for like a joke. I think a lot of this stuff is Tao Lin was very good at this, like they're almost like conceptual pieces, because if you ask anyone like, what do you think about shoplifting? What do you think about Richard Yates? What do you think about Taipei? They will go like, man, that book was funny. There's a lot of like internet stuff in there, but they can't really tell you anything that happened so much except for the one where it's the relationship with a underage girl, which we're not going to talk about. But you feel me? It's like,
yeah, no, the style was more important than the content, arguably, at least in that early work. He's kind of shifted where his content is like the things that are interesting to him. So it's, you know, maybe that's not the case, yeah. But
and I even read his new stuff, but I'm sure I'm happy, you know, whatever. I talk a lot of shit about Tao Lin, but I really love those books, but just from a conceptual thing now, cause now I'm a grown man and that stuff, it just doesn't have as much. I don't know. You know, when you're younger, like, I don't know. I was really into Glenn Branca and his like guitar orchestra. You know what I mean? And that was like it's like, this is music. You can just fucking break a guitar and have like 30 detuned guitars and stuff like that. And but now as an older man, I don't, that stuff doesn't hit me emotionally. And that's what I'm looking for art now. And yeah, that's the art that's always stayed with me, you know,
I feel that way.
Chloe, you were talking about, I'm not going to try and poorly paraphrase you, but, the listeners will know because they have listened to a thing. And I said that I disagreed with you. And I don't know if that's entirely true. I think, an issue, or not an issue, I take, just a comment I have is like, not everyone's going to be able to do a reading. You know, that stuff is important for a reading, and that's like a performance kind of thing. But what is the longevity of that kind of stuff when it's in the written? Because I don't think people's attention spans are really that dilated. I think we are kind of shooting ourselves in the foot and expecting readers to just, because who reads us? You know what I mean? None of us have broken out. Well, especially not me. I'm a nobody. You know, who's reading our stuff outside of our circle? And why is that? You know what I mean? And so it takes a certain bar of entry to even get into this like pseudo emotional stuff. And if it's not hitting someone emotionally, just point blank without like having to have like, oh, this is a riff on this or this, you know, I guess that's where my disagreement comes from. I think art should be mostly about communication.
I agree completely with that. I think actually maybe the problem with the attention span actually lies more in the content of what's being, you know, it's not necessarily that our attention spans are shot, but it's like maybe the work that we're reading isn't grabbing us. And it's actually like a skill issue.
Yeah. And you know, this is a thing, because I've said that I don't like your poetry very much, and that is true, but I don't like a lot of poetry. But your prose is unique, and it seems like the opposite of that. You try and make a more fleshed out world. You take your time more with a character and more with a situation of relaying a more constructed world that is often, I think, especially with the JFK piece, like a not RFK, whatever the fuck that retard is called. But you take the time to make like a facility of this world to relay a character's emotion. And I think I have problems with all kinds of pieces. If you need an editor, let me know. I'll help you edit. But with that, I saw such talent in there that can be shaped really well. And I think that you are going on a path different than a lot of other writers. You know what I'm saying? Maybe I'm kind of rambling.
I agree. In the same vein as when, you know, you were saying with Tao Lin, and when he first came on the scene and people, it was something novel, it was something different. And now it's kind of just imitations of that and not, you know, not a progression or like an inspiration, but like imitations. I think the same way with, like, for example, like Marie Calloway, like when first was, you know, when she was doing her thing and her pieces, I feel like there are a lot of female writers nowadays who are just kind of using the same format and not necessarily pivoting off of it, because, you know, fledgling writers will imitate, but the problem is not progressing beyond that point. And I think a lot of my contemporaries, you know, and some of them do a good job. I mean, it's just, it's a crutch that I think that my contemporary female writers use, is to write about that subject matter in a Marie Calloway way. And you can't do that, really.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And Wallace and I had talked about this during our interview portion. And I think we kind of came to an agreement, because we were kind of, we came to an agreement, really, that I think that, things should, how do I put this? Like, people should be, what are people's direction forward? What do they want to relay? And I think a lot of writers today don't know what they want to relay, and they can just kind of pop off stuff, short things, because that's really in vogue to just write a short thing, and then they can get published, and then they get their attention points, and then nobody remembers it after a while. And I think that's basically, Wallace, you and I really disagreed about like concept versus craft, but there is definitely, I think there can be a great middle ground, and I think Chloe could. I think you reach a good middle ground in there, because I'm super craft minded. I'm all about word structure and stuff like that. And Wallace is maybe more idealistic than me, which is good. That's a very good thing. I honestly believe that. I think that's good, of like a concept can really grab people. And I think you do a good job of walking that middle. I'm not trying to glaze you, of course. but I think you, there's flashes of that that I can see in your work, and I can see why he picked you to do this, because it is like, it, you know.
Well, I'll say it's kind of, it is an intentional thing that I'm doing, because when I say that, like, the brief, you know, terseness is what sells, I'm like aware of that, and also aware of the cheapness of it. But I also do really value craft. I mean, for a long time, I really had no knowledge of like alt lit, and didn't know about all of these, like, you know, publications like Hobart or Expat or whatnot. It was just not. So I was all like about traditional writing, and my writing, you know, that's what I mimicked when I was in school. And I've had this, brought up to me by a friend of mine, Billy, because he was mentioning that the work that I read at readings is very different from the work that I publish online. And he was like, he's like, yeah, I feel like you're like, you know, it cheapens it. And he's like, unless this is something, this is like a tactic, and it kind of is a tactic. I often do, when I do literary readings, I'll kind of, I'll do like say two poems, and one of them is sort of the meme poem thing that's kind of swept the downtown scene, and I can do that. I can bring the humor and know how to use it in a way that is strategic, and then I'll, bring forth a piece that was, had a lot of thought and craft and editing that spanned years into it. And I want people to know that I can do both, and I don't know what I'm doing when I am using, say, the cheap way of communicating, but it is still imbued with the meaning. And I think that people do see that, but it is an intentional thing.
I think like what I like about Chloe's writing is Chloe's always interesting. She never bores me. I never feel it never feels dull. I'm always interested to read it, excited to read it, and it delivers. And I think that's one of the hardest things for a writer. It's like the first commandment and maybe the only commandment: don't be boring. And
Yeah, if you don't have something to say, don't say. I mean, like, that's the motive point. Also, thank you, Wallace. But yeah, I think a lot of people are motivated. There's a lot of like clout writers nowadays and clout readings, and you can tell. I mean, people, not even necessarily just people who are interested in literature, but anyone can tell. And maybe that's what I was driving at with my kind of nebulous response to your previous question was just that, yeah, I do agree with you, and I also welcome disagreement and critique and criticism. I honestly like live for it. I'd rather somebody give me an honest critique than a false compliment.
well, that I think that's good. That's the way to be. It took
Yeah.
me, unfortunately, too long. I still am bad with this. I'll finish like a paragraph and I'll be like, Lynn, come read this. Come re
I love
give me some attention.
it.
It is interesting to think about because I'm isolated out here in Detroit. I'm on the internet, and I think a lot of people are, and so we're not part of scenes like that anymore. So I think at least for me, it is. It helps me make more sense of why other writers write kind of like that because, I guess I just had completely not thought about the performance aspect of it. And like you're writing these to go and perform these kind of things. And
Oh.
and that's a much different thing than like you were saying, going to a reading and listening to someone, that's like a performance. That's like you are doing this stuff. And that's a lot different than someone sitting down and reading a book. You know what I mean? It's just different mediums, essentially. It is just this different, it's spoken word, versus like reading. So writing's harder. You know,
Yeah.
writing's hard, man. It sucks. A lot of the time it's not any fun at all. When you that's just the truth of it. What was this? The last week or the week before, people talk about who's going to write the internet novel. This whole concept of an internet novel is so backwards to me. Like, how do we write about the internet? It's just like your job, like as a writer, right, should be to take in the world, render it, and then give it back to the world so that they can understand the world you're living in or the world that all of us are sharing, right? And so this whole concept of like an internet, it's like. The internet's no different than our life. Just write about your fucking life and
Yes.
be able to do it in a concise way. Or taking, like Lynn was saying before, taking your feelings, your emotions, your thoughts, and being able to beam them and transfer them to another person so that they can feel those things.
Yeah.
And the craft is how you do that, right? Like the tools, like you, everything that you read and every author you like and you try and emulate and replicate, it's like you're taking those tools, you're seeing how these words work, like pop music, honestly. Like these four chords work in this way and they make someone feel this way. And I don't see writing as any different than that. And so that's why I just am very craft oriented. You know what I mean? Because that is that to me, that's the way that you make yourself understood to others. I think a lot of writers are really into self-expression, and I think that's stupid and disgusting to me because the self's going to come out.
Yeah, it's like people are so self-absorbed. I mean, it's a culture of narcissism. But I think that when you focus on the craft, concept will follow, and concept can be useful for marketing purposes and getting it out there. But if you're thinking too much on that, like the internet, not like that's absurd to me, because it's like, yeah, the internet is part of our lives. It'll probably actually get in there somehow. You can, I don't like, I used to want to like, for example, I wrote this screenplay a couple years ago, and when I first wrote it, I wanted it to be timeless.
The thing about timeless art, it's what makes it timeless is those feelings and those characters are universal across time. Not necessarily the situations and stuff like that. Just like someone will always feel this way somewhere. You know what I mean? Yeah, so maybe timeless is capturing life.
Yeah. And even that goal is kind of besides the point. Like another book that I really like, a theory book, is The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. It's great. I mean, it's written very well. I mean, the concepts are one thing, and it's so poetically constructed. But it, like, we go on these like heroism projects in order to like escape death and convince ourselves of immortality, and and it talks about like how Freud kind of did that in his work, and was sort of misguided by, like, he has this idea, this religion, and he's going to abide by it even though there are holes in it, and like he's right to a certain extent. But anyway, like the grandiosity of it all, basically the final statement in that book was not a solution, like there really is none, but that we just contribute what we can and throw something into the void, and hopefully it's meaningful.
Like Tyson loves custom model, stuck in the gang. Like Tyson loves custom model. Yeah, it's a picture, yeah, it's a job. Maybe that's why I do it so odd. Walk around just like I was God. Kick it so live when I'm with the gods. Freeway striking, weed we lighten. If I die, remember the Titan with 22s, 25s, chocolate 9s and 45s. Let them rip off through the sky. Just for the ones that hate that I'm high. When you see me, it's no surprise. Tap your brain and blow your mind. Betting on Lakers and takers and fakers and makers. And mommy, we do it for paper. You come with the vapors or capers and vapors. It's cool. Someone will call later. Yeah, cause me and my homies love the bottle.
Mike Tyson loves custom bottles.
So on them days you feeling real bad, think of the best freak that you ever had. Garlic tipped and they love the hollow.
Mike Tyson loves custom models.
So before you go to getting mad, think of the best freak that you ever had. She like the Nikes, I like Adidas. She like the Reeboks and I like the Feelers. She like the winners and I like the cheaters. She like the lion, I like the hyenas. Spit some game, then hook up with Shaq. On the PlayStation, I'm known to brag. Hook up with pimps that love.